Okay, ladies and gentlemen, it's my pleasure to welcome to the Solari Report John Laughlin, who has joined us once before. He is the Director of Studies at the Institute of Democracy and Cooperation in Paris, France. He's coming into us from Paris. He is a historian. He's an author, very successful journalist, author of many excellent books. One, the first that I read of his, The Tainted Source, The Undemocratic Origins of the European Idea, published in 1997. I first met John in London and heard his description of the challenges that he foresaw with the European Union. And John, you predicted it. It was prophetic. So I'm not happy about that, but...
Yes, I mean, I wrote mainly about the constitutional aspects, but I did have a chapter on the currency side. And in the run-up to the introduction of the currency union, of monetary union, I wrote an awful lot of articles for the Wall Street Journal about the problem of debt and how the European Union was trying to resolve it, and how in fact they were disobeying their own rules on debt. And indeed, you've kindly used the word prophetic, but I'm sure if I dusted off those old articles now, nearly 20 years after the event, then they would indeed seem prophetic, because of course the single currency, the euro, is foundering on the fact that the debt rules have never been respected.
Right, and of course this new announcement from the ECB is more of the same.
Yes.
I wanted to start. I mentioned earlier to you that Richard Haass, who's the head of the Council on Foreign Relations here, in the November-December issue of Foreign Affairs published an article called The Unraveling, and he closed it by saying that the Bretton Woods system is breaking down and we're on our way to a new world disorder. And I interpreted it as a warning to the neocons to stand down, that they were creating too much disorder in the world, and that where America was headed was not in a good place. And I know one of the reasons I wanted you to come on with us is I've been watching, of course, the Russian sanctions roll out, but it's part of a process since the, particularly since 9/11, when America is trying very hard to assert dominance in Eurasia, and that's coming at greater and greater cost to Europe. And so maybe we could start with the United States effort in Europe and Eurasia, and what is happening in Europe and what it means to Europe.
Well, I think that's a very good place to start, and I particularly like the remark you've put into your question about how Europe pays the price, as it were, for these policies. The immediate relationship of American foreign policy to Russia and the Ukraine business is that in the minds of people like Brzezinski, Zbigniew Brzezinski, who, although he doesn't formally belong to the neocon club, nonetheless has formulated a lot of ideas that have found support both among neocons and in the American foreign policy establishment generally. He, in his famous book, The Grand Chessboard, which is always worth rereading, described Ukraine as the bridgehead, as America's bridgehead into Eurasia. And so in the logic, in Brzezinski's logic, in the logic of these people, it's essential to have Ukraine in order to be able to control the Eurasian continent and to prevent anyone else from controlling it instead. And that I mention that because I do think that the decision to tear Ukraine away from its natural role, its natural geopolitical role, which is, of course, is to be a bridge between Europe and Russia, the decision to tear it away from that natural role, the only role, incidentally, in which the country can survive, was taken with that logic in mind. And it was taken in particular as part of the plan, which is both an economic and also a political and geopolitical plan, to create, of course, a transatlantic free trade zone. That's the big issue on the agenda at the moment. The big issue is to get this transatlantic free trade zone going, to consolidate thereby the what is now universally known as the West. We don't talk about Europe and America anymore. We just use this rather abstract term. The West, of course, which defines itself in very postmodern terms, not in terms of allegiance to states or in terms of relationship to history or anything like that, but instead in terms of, you know, gay rights, human rights, sort of all postmodern values and so on. And in the longer term, of course, the creation of a transatlantic free trade zone will, in my view, I mean, this hasn't really been discussed yet as far as I know, perhaps it has, but I haven't seen any articles, would logically, of course, lead to the creation of a transatlantic single currency. In the European Union, no sooner had the single market been completed in 1986, it wasn't completed until 1992, but the Single European Act, which provided for it, was completed and signed in and ratified in 1986. No sooner had that happened than immediately Europe's leaders said, well, we can't have a single market without a single currency. And that's where the euro started. I cannot see any reason why the same logic would not apply to a transatlantic free trade zone. It doesn't make sense to have a free trade zone with different currencies, particularly when those currencies are floating against each other. And this brings me back to what you say about the breakdown of the Bretton Woods system. Bretton Woods system broke down a long time ago. But we often forget, don't we, that when, for instance, the European Community was founded and when the idea was first mooted of a single common market, and when you know, other steps were taken towards liberalizing trade in the early days, I'm talking about in the late 60s and 70s. At that stage, of course, there was, in a sense, a single currency. Not that there wasn't a single currency, but there was a system of fixed exchange rates, and that meant that there was a direct mechanism for comparing prices in one part of the single market or the one part of the common market to another, and that was true, of course, within Europe, but also between Europe and America, because everything was pegged to the dollar, and the dollar was in turn pegged to the to gold. That's, of course, ancient history now.
Right.
The logic still applies. It doesn't make sense, and this is one of the big blind spots, really, of so-called free market thinking. The logic still applies. It doesn't make sense to have a single market or a free trade zone if at the same time within that zone national currencies can fluctuate each other, fluctuate against each other, completely overturning the normal reality-based economic relationships within the different part of the zone. Basically, if one of the countries devalues, then suddenly its products become a lot cheaper. And that clearly, you know, doesn't make sense within a free trade zone. So, as I say, I think that this project, the project of the transatlantic free trade area, can only lead to plans for a single currency. And that takes us back to the whole issue, as you say, of the end of Bretton Woods and the impossibility of resolving the debt issue, both in America and in Europe. The debt now is so enormous on both sides of the Atlantic that it can never be repaid. And in order to get out of a situation in which you can't repay your debts, the only way to do it is, of course, to is to use trickery, basically, and to you know, invent a new currency and to, you know, roll over the debt even more.
Well, what they can do is, can't they continuously debase, and, you know, what we're watching is the rise of the equity markets as the debasement continues. So.
Yes.
You know, I think, you know, it's very interesting because you have everyone in Davos talking about, oh dear, the inequality, while the ECB is announcing again another trillion to ensure that the inequality continues.
Mm.
Because as you debase, you create greater and greater inequality. Those who are, you know, those who own real assets are protected, and or who are the beneficiaries of the quantitative easing. So the inequality just continues to rise. So it was quite remarkable to watch the Davos to Brussels this week in Europe.
Yes. No, indeed, that's right. But that's the situation that we're in as of today. We know that everyone is, or not everyone, but the major countries are indeed debasing and devaluing. It's a recipe for chaos. There's no doubt about it.
One of the things you pointed out in one of your interviews over the last year is the remarkable loyalty of the European leaders to the U.S.
Yes.
Which is hard to fathom, because if you look at the price that Europe is paying for the Russian sanctions,
yes,
and for the squabble in the Ukraine, it's and we should talk about the Ukraine, but the Ukraine is paying a huge price, but Europe is also paying a huge price. Maybe if you could talk about what the sanctions are doing.
But I do know anecdotal evidence. I know that, dairy factories in Normandy are working, 2 days a week now only because of these Russian sanctions, because they used to have huge exports to Russia. Apparently there are something like 700,000 apples that have not been exported from Poland to Russia because are, of course, the retaliatory Russian sanctions. Russia has, in retaliation for the sanctions, has cut agricultural imports from Europe. On the other side of the equation, France risks losing a very, very large sum of money indeed, if it fails to deliver these two helicopter carrier ships, which one of which has been built and is ready to go, and the other one is nearly finished. They've been paid for, but France said at the last minute, or last September anyway, that they wouldn't be delivered because of the Ukraine issue. And that the costs of that are in the billions for France. But, of course, in a sense, they're much bigger even than the price that's been paid for the ships. The cost to France is reputation as a supplier of military equipment and of arms, will suffer immensely because France is very clearly in breach of contract on this. And if other potential buyers see a major industrial producer like France changing its mind at the last minute on a whim, they're very unlikely, I think, to place major orders in future. So, yes, it's a classic example of how European leaders follow American policies, but as you say, then they have to bear the consequences in a way which America does much less. The consequences are economic in the specific issue of the sanctions against Russia on Ukraine, but there are much more important, I think, social consequences for other aspects of this foreign policy alignment. I'm thinking of the support given to the rebels in Syria in the rebellion there, which started in 2011, which of course has caused that country to implode, and as we know, has facilitated the creation of the Islamic State, which in turn has, as you know, spread into Iraq. All this turmoil, encouraged and egged on by the Americans and the Europeans, apart from being horrible for the people who live in Syria and Iraq, also has an effect on us in Europe, because, of course, there are huge numbers of refugees. There is a massive immigration problem all over Europe. Europe is swamped now with people who have come from Afghanistan and the Middle East, who have been smuggled and who have got here illegally. The numbers are gigantic. In Germany, for example, in 2008, the total immigration into Germany was something around 20,000 people a year. Now the figure is nearer 500,000.
Good Lord.
There's been an absolutely dramatic increase in the number of people. And those figures are slightly lower, but comparable figures apply also to France and Britain. And only just after Christmas, I was returning to France from Britain by boat, and as we drove the car off the ferry in Calais in France, you could see the place absolutely swarming with refugees on the roadside and basically trying to get into the perimeter of the ferry terminal in order to cross the channel into England. So we can see the very direct effect of these things, and of course, needless to say, they're having an effect on the on social questions and on domestic policy. There's a big anti-Islam movement now in Germany, which is causing huge ructions. There's one in Spain. It's been an issue in the Netherlands for a long time. none of this really affects America because America is further away. You can't smuggle yourself in a lorry from Afghanistan to America. You have to go there by plane or conceivably by boat. But you can smuggle yourself by land through Turkey and so on into Europe. It's very easy, and hundreds of thousands of people do it all the time.
Well, at the same time, isn't the median age growing? You have the same problem in Europe that we have here, which is the median age is rising, and the native populations are in what some people would refer to as a demographic winter.
Yes,
so,
absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, that's a whole separate issue. But yes, it's,
right.
It only adds to the general sense of gloom and doom, of course, because as we know, the elites, the oligarchical elites which govern the world, and particularly America and Europe, say that immigration is the answer to this, and that the more immigrants we bring in, the better it will be, and the demographic problem will be solved and all the rest of it. Well, that's one way of looking at it. It's certainly not a point of view I agree with, and I often think that such mass immigration is supported precisely not for sound economic reasons, but instead for ideological reasons. You know, the idea being that nations should no longer have a sense of ethnic belonging. They should not have any ethnic basis. They should instead be sort of disembodied constitutional structures in which any people from any background can feel at home. That's the ideology, and immigration is used to advance that ideology.
Well, you certainly have the feeling here that there is tremendous effort coming from the leadership and the media to debase and destroy the culture. And I think that's what is communicated to me by friends in Europe. They're struggling with the same, and it's almost as though you're trying to reduce the culture down to the lowest, most simplistic mind.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Now, you have elections this year and next year. I mean, we start with the Greek elections at the end of the month. What is the impact of elections?
They're on Sunday. They're on there this Sunday.
Yeah.
So, yes, the end of the month. But, yes, this is actually this Sunday. It's not the end of the month. It's this. It's on the 25th of January.
Well, the sense I got from Davos was more than ever people were, or leadership was worried about the appearance. The problem's almost too overwhelming for them individually to do anything about. And, of course, you know, here in America, as you know, our political leaders have very little power and authority and less each day. So what I'm wondering is, what is the impact this year and next year of elections? The French elections are next year, am I right?
The French elections are in 2017. So there's
17.
To go yet before they take place. But you're right to raise them, because already French political life has been completely sucked dry by speculation about the forthcoming presidential election. One of the phenomena of this draining away of power that you've mentioned, which is true, I think, probably even more of European politicians than it is of American ones, is that precisely because there is no politics anymore, all people talk about is, certainly in France, is the next election. And even though it's still got two years to go, France, as I say, is now completely consumed with the question of who will be the candidates, and then who will be the victor in the presidential election. It's a very sad state of affairs. The Greek election, I think, will be quite important. Because everybody, all the opinion polls seem to indicate that Syriza will win and form a government. And certainly, I mean, I don't know Greece well, but certainly I think feeling is running very, very high there. The situation is absolutely catastrophic in terms of living standards, which have gone through the floor. There has been an explosion of poverty. Obviously, huge numbers of people have been put out of work. Public services have been cut and so on. I think it is a very, very bad situation. But above all, the medicine hasn't worked. The debt to GDP ratio has in fact shot up, because of course the economy has contracted massively, and so the GDP figures are much lower. So the thing hasn't worked, and Syriza is on a winning ticket when it says this, because everyone can see the hardship, which they conceivably might have expected if it had made the figures turn round, but it hasn't. If it wins, then obviously we have to see, we have to wait and see. I'm always skeptical about whether politicians will really do what they say they're going to do. But Syriza has, of course, campaigned on a very anti-austerity ticket. And if it does turn round to the IMF and the European Union and say, we're not going to play by your rules anymore, then, of course, we could be looking at a breakdown of the currency union. It's completely right on the cards. My feeling, again, I don't have any privileged information, but my guess is that the European leadership is braced for this. I think their main worry at the beginning of the euro crisis was, so in 2011 really, was that their own banks would get hit. And as we know, the various bailout plans are, of course, bailout plans for banks to reduce their exposure to bad debt. And that's all been more or less taken care of now. So probably they're thinking, well, you know, at least as far as our banks are concerned, we can let Greece go because all their debts have been paid off. The bad debts have been basically dealt right with. And so, and obviously that's what they care about most. So maybe that's the calculation, and maybe that's why the possible election of Syriza has been treated with perhaps less panic than one might otherwise have expected. On the other hand, again, I think it is a very interesting development if indeed that party takes power, because you know, as people have been saying since the euro crisis started, since the debt crisis really started, that, you know, there'll be a domino effect, and that if Greece goes, then other countries will follow before long. And the country that I think will follow more in a sense than the other real southern European countries like Spain and Portugal is Italy. Italy, which to all intents and purposes is a much more prosperous state than any of the others, but which nonetheless I think would be quite badly hit by a Greek exit from the euro. And of course, if Italy left the euro, then you know, that really would deal a very serious blow indeed to the single currency project.
Right. I see so much pressure coming top down for, you know, going the other way, the transatlantic free trade zone, as you described. And also the rise of, you know, India and China are now growing, rising, and the threat of being a smaller market is also, I think, part of the push. And so you have,
yes,
you know, you have two logics coming that argue for centralization, but that centralization keeps imploding the economy bottom up. And so there's this terrible, terrible tension. And to me, the leaders are caught in the middle. There were, the head of Luxembourg once said, we know what to do, we just don't know how to get elected after we do it. And so, you know, and I really see this tension just reaching an unbearable level, both here and there over the next 2 to 3 years. And it's going to be very interesting to see how it gets resolved.
The problem is one doesn't know when it's going to reach unbearable levels. And, you know, in spite of its inherent fragility, the system nonetheless remains very strong, doesn't it?
Right, it does.
I mentioned earlier the anti-Islam movement in Germany. It's not directly related to these issues of income and so on, or the economy, but it is part of a broader malaise. Well, the system has scored a number of tactical victories in the last 24 hours against that movement. The head of it had to resign yesterday or the day before yesterday. And the march plan, which has been going on every Monday for 2 or 3 months now, was cancelled last week, and this week will be changed from Monday to Sunday. So there have already been a number of tactical victories. And, you know, this is ultimately a fairly small issue, the way that this movement has been attacked by the establishment. But it's symbolic of a very general problem, a very widespread problem, which is the impossibility, the incapacity of protest groups such as this one to you know, constitute themselves as genuine alternatives and to make themselves into real challenges to power. Syriza is an exception. And we'll see if they succeed. But all the conservative, Syriza, of course, is a left-wing group, but all the more conservative movements that exist, some of which are very strong, are still, I'm thinking of the National Front in France, are still a long way from power.
I wanted to bring up the question of the neocons, John, because you were one of the people who first got me to really look at them as a group. And the neocon, you know, when I worked in the Bush administration, I had exposure to them. Mm. And since I've had the opportunity to study them, and the thing that really struck me when I worked with them is the extent to which they did not believe in the law. They really saw both domestic and international laws and inconvenience that belonged to an old paradigm and didn't relate to them. And one of the reasons I so admire and respect your work is, of course, you've done a lot to understand, study the history, the current condition of international law. So you seem to come from the opposite tradition. And but they were very, I don't know if you've seen Charlie Ferguson's documentary on Iraq, you know, but it's almost as though the Romans brought law and infrastructure and the Americans bring chaos and a breakdown of civil order.
Yeah.
And, you know, I hate to use the word demonic, but having worked with them, I found them to be literally demonic.
Exaggeration. Yeah.
Right.
There is a very demonic aspect to it. And certainly the notion of chaos is a key notion. There is an idea it's expressed, for example, it's going back a while now, but I think it was David Frum who has a very demonic passage in one of his books about, or perhaps it was Michael Ledeen, about destruction is our middle name, and how it was Ledeen, and how, you know, our force lies in our power to destroy and to, you know, to destroy old structures. Of course, the implication was that they would replace them with new ones, but what we see, in fact, is that they just, you know, they make a desert and they call it peace.
Right.
So, yeah, and what I think for me the most sobering, one of the most sobering events of the last few months has been to see in the person of Victoria Nuland, otherwise known as Mrs. Robert Kagan, how powerful they still remain. You know, this is, it's 15 years after all, after their, or 10 years anyway, more than 10 years after their great triumph in getting the war on Iraq launched in 2003. But, you know, guess what? They're still there. They are still in very important positions. Nuland is relatively senior in the State Department. She's played a key role in this Ukraine crisis, which is probably the most important foreign policy issue of 2014-2015. And there she stands, you know, there they stand.
Right.
She is a fully paid up member of that group, at least through her marriage to her husband. She's also representative of neocons in the sense that she started off working in Dick Cheney's office. She comes from the Republican side, but she's perfectly at home in the Democratic administration of Barack Obama. And this just shows how powerful and influential they remain. They can occupy key positions in either Republican or Democrat administrations.
Right, and the only, you know, I don't know Nuland, but my impression of them is these were people who were not able to deal with complexity. And their way of dealing with complexity was to basically use force to simplify. It's almost like the chaos, reducing complex systems to something chaotic and base made it possible for them to understand the world. Mm. And so the question is, if you have, you know, so I'll just use the word, I call them thugs.
Yeah.
So the question is, where does their power come from? Why do we see thugs visited upon the world and continue to do enormous amounts of destruction? I mean, every time somebody says to me, well, the economy's slowing down, I said, well, of course it's slowing down. You're destroying it. What do you expect it to do when you destroy it? Because economy depends on trust. So, or markets depend on trust. So I mean, I think the big mystery for all of us is, and, you know, why should I be asking you? You're in Europe and we're visiting this upon the world. I should have the answer here. Why did the neocons continue to gain and hold power?
Well, that is a question that, of course, is difficult to answer. I mean, one answer is that the ideas that they embody are shared, as I said earlier in reference to Brzezinski, are shared by, they go way beyond the neocon community itself, strictly speaking. And they are shared by large, large sections of the political establishment in the United States and in Europe. So they've managed to be influential way beyond their own ranks.
Right.
Influential isn't really even the right word. I think hegemonic would be a proper word because, you know, as we know, in the entire Congress, the previous Congress, there was only one congressman who voted against all this stuff. I'm thinking, of course, of Ron Paul. So, you know, the hegemony, the intellectual and political hegemony is absolutely breathtaking.
Right.
The causes of it are, as I say, I think you are probably closer to answer, closer to the, to you're physically closer to an answer than.
Well, I'll give you one.
As far as the question of thuggery is concerned, that might be a key to the answer because, of course, you know, stupidity does tend to win out over intelligence. Brutishness can win out over civilization. Civilization is very difficult to build up. It takes a long time. It's very easy to smash it up. It's much easier to smash something up than it is to create something. And I just think that's a part of human nature.
We saw a change in policy. I'll give you an example here of what I think may be happening. We saw a change in policy with the Attorney General announcing the end of the state and local share of asset forfeiture. Asset forfeiture in the United States since the 90s has been on a tear of building out. It's kind of a nuts and bolts of building out a war on terror done first through the drug war and then through terrorism. But it literally has given enforcers at the state, local, and federal level the ability to seize personal assets without any evidence or proof of wrongdoing. And it's been quite effective at sort of building out a control system at the state, local, and federal level. So the AG canceled the local, state, and local share after an editorial about a month ago in the Economist saying America had gone too far and the enforcement system was destroying the trust that was the basis of the economy. And my read on this is, you know, thugs are very useful for building out the system. But once the system is built out, you need the system to be credible, and you no longer need them. And so my question globally is, are the thugs being used to build out the system? You know, they just haven't achieved what they want yet. So the thugs are still upon us at the global level. Anyway, so it's a theory. Which leads me to my point that one of the things you've seen over the last 2 months is more and more bumper stickers in America saying Putin for president. You know, we have the 2016 election, presidential election here. So people are talking now about the primaries. And I think one of the, there's an enormous hunger in the American body politic for somebody who can make the case for the rule of law. You know, it's felt very deeply here and, you know, but people are scared, and so it's not necessarily, you don't necessarily see the discussion of it. And so I had to bring up the recent legislation. I know very little about it, but I laughed and I thought of you when I saw it. We just got news this week that the Duma has proposed legislation to outlaw or basically govern and force NGOs in Russia. I don't know if you know anything about that.
I don't think it's quite as you say. I mean, there's a long history of laws governing NGOs in Russia. I'm not aware of one. I very much doubt there's anything outlawing them. What there has been, but it was introduced not recently, but a year or two ago, was a law requiring NGOs which receive foreign funding to register as foreign agents. That caused a big uproar. Whether they've changed it or modified this law recently, I don't know. But the law which caused so much protest was voted more than a year ago. But as I say, it doesn't limit their activities at all. It doesn't place any limits on them at all. It's merely that they have. It's like a fiscal requirement. They have to register themselves as foreign agents to announce the fact that they receive foreign funding. It's been, of course, by Russia's enemies as a restrictive law restricting the activities of these NGOs. But I'm afraid that's a complete lie.
Well, I'm glad to hear the details on it. But I bring it up because to me the combination of the neocon lawlessness fronted by the NGOs spouting moral platitudes I find it particularly offensive. So I thought I would ask you to maybe say a few words about what the NGO's role is in the so-called soft revolution tactics of the American Empire.
They play a key role. I don't agree, though, that the revolutions are soft that they promote. The revolution in Ukraine of the 22nd of February 2014 was not soft. It was a violent affair,
yes,
which came about as the result of an absolutely ruthless and violent group, which the now government, then opposition, used in order to overthrow the not only democratically elected but also universally recognized president.
Right.
That event does indeed, yes, I mean, it symbolizes all the things you've been asking about, the neocon, not just neocon, but the contempt for the rule of law, absolutely brazen contempt, because, as I'm sure you know, the three European foreign ministers had sponsored a compromise between the then president and the then opposition, which provided for early elections and an interim government to prepare them. But the ink was hardly dry on it when they overthrew Yanukovych, when they overthrew the president. And
right.
The European and American governments turned around and said this was all totally legal, which was just a blatant lie. And of course, to add insult to injury, they then said that the secession of Crimea from Ukraine was itself illegal. It may have been illegal, but it took place in conditions in which the constitutional order in Ukraine had broken down anyway. And of course, they didn't use the same argument when Yugoslavia broke up. They didn't say the secessions of Croatia and Slovenia were illegal, although they clearly were as well. So yes, the coup in Ukraine shows this conjunction of contempt for the rule of law, thuggishness, and I would very much emphasize the readiness and perhaps even desire to use force. In the run-up to it, I denounced in many interviews the violence of the then opposition, now government in Kiev. It was quite clear to me, even before the 22nd of February, that they were determined to seize power by force. And that's what they
did. In my experience, the soft revolution is quite violent, but the violence is a great effort is made to make it invisible and covert, if possible. So, but I agree with you.
I'm just referring to street fights.
Yeah.
I mean, there were very serious street fights between armed rebels and the police and the army, or certainly the police anyway. And these fights led to very large numbers of, scores anyway, of deaths of policemen, hundreds of injuries of policemen. They were proper pitched battles being fought in the streets of the capital. So it was, in that sense, a classic violent revolution.
So my last question, John, as I step back and I look at this from a very long-term perspective, one of the things that is baffling is if you look at all of the locations of cultures that have traditionally treasured the Judeo-Christian heritage, what we're watching is literally those areas being torn apart and fighting with each other. You know, you would think there was a natural cultural cohesion of everyone in the traditionally Judeo-Christian cult, or the places that you know are predominantly Judeo-Christian, and yet this is tearing us right down the middle.
Yeah.
And I wonder if you could say something about this from a cultural standpoint.
I very much agree with that and feel it very deeply. Myself, you're referring, of course, to the division between Russia and the rest of the West, because this, you know, makes no sense at all in civilizational terms. It makes no sense at all for a new dividing line to be drawn, as Huntington himself wanted it to be drawn, along the border between Catholicism and Orthodoxy. Huntington said back in 92 or whatever it was he wrote, The Clash of Civilizations, that Greece does not belong to Western civilization. An absolutely incredible statement. Incredible.
Greece does not belong to Western civilization?
Yeah.
Oh, my Lord.
The Clash of Civilizations, I can give you the page reference. Simply because his division runs along the line of Orthodoxy, so all the Orthodox countries don't belong to the West, according to him. And, you know, it's nuts. It's literally nuts. But that is the view, and again, you know, one is just amazed by the hegemony and power of these ideas, because now that's what we're seeing implemented. And that not only is such a division completely crazy in civilizational terms, it's also suicidal in view of the things you mentioned earlier, the rise of India and China, obviously the rise of Islam and so on. You know, in such circumstances, it would indeed make sense for the Christian and Jewish, Judeo-Christian world to unite. It doesn't make sense for it to be divided, and yet it is.
Yeah, it's quite... all I can tell you is the thing that continues to baffle me. It's the neocons, but it's wider. Starting in the 90s, what I watched was it was as though the Americans had lost their mind. And Leonard Cohen has a song where he says they were blinded by the beauty of their weapons.
Yeah.
But literally, as the wall came down and you know, the Soviet Union came apart, the Americans got a very overblown estimate of their power, and you know, that has not gotten, you know, that has not transformed into something more mature. If anything, it seems to be debased, and so
that is the
thing we're grappling with. And I know Europe is grappling with it, and this will be a year of trying to sort that out. So any suggestions you have, if you're an American sitting and listening to this, any suggestions as to what we can do that would be positive?
Ask Ron Paul to come out of retirement.
You know, it's really interesting. Since the early 90s, one of the ways I cheer myself up whenever I'm depressed is I send a check to Ron Paul. Well,
sending them.
I will keep sending them. Well, John, it's always a pleasure. You are a beacon of light for all of us, not just in Europe, but here in the United States. We appreciate your work very much. If there's ever anything we can do to support you, you have only to ask. And we wish you the best year possible.
And you too. All right. Thank you so much. Bye.
Thank you. Bye.
Bye.